Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service and PRI.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now.
Good job tonight.
We're learning more today about that comment that President Obama made to Secretary of Defense Leon Panetta last night as he made his way to the podium to deliver the State of the Union address. He was complimenting Panetta on a special forces raid on a Somali pirate base that led to the rescue of two hostages, a Dane, Paul Thisted, and 32-year-old American Jessica Buchanan, both of whom were aid workers for the mine-clearing unit of the Danish Refugee Council, who'd been kidnapped by pirates last October. Officials at the Pentagon reportedly watched that raid unfold, as they did with the killing of Osama bin Laden. And we're also learning today that the operation was carried out by the same Navy SEAL Team 6 that killed bin Laden in that raid on his compound in Pakistan last May. Here's Vice President Joseph Biden speaking about last night's raid in Somalia on ABC this morning.
The president personally authorized this. We have our special operations forces. I'm not going to go into more detail than that, who are, by the way, the most incredible warriors this world has ever seen. They said it was the time, the opportunity. Jessica's health was they worried was failing, and they concluded they should go at this time. The president gave the go.
A U.S. journalist was also kidnapped this past weekend in Somalia. He's reportedly also being held along with other hostages by the pirates. Let's get the latest from the BBC's Will Ross. He's East Africa correspondent for the BBC, and we've reached him on a very scratchy cell phone from the region. But, Will, what do we know about the raid at this point?
Well, the raid was in the middle of the night, about 2 o'clock in the night, local time, in Somalia. And Jessica Buchanan and Paul Hayne-Tidsell were being held in a remote area on the coast. And what we understand, according to the American officials, is that these U.S. Navy SEALs parachuted down from a plane and landed in the approximate area of where the two aid workers were being held. We understand there was some gunfire. We are told that nine of the Somali gang were killed, but both Jessica and Paul were rescued and were taken out safely to the military base in Djibouti, the American military base there. So an extraordinary operation. It's very rare that anybody would dare to go on land in Somalia. And remember, this is an area where there is no government. The gangs and their guns are in charge.
Well, and there are some reports that pirates who were captured said that these pirates were kind of knocked out. They chew a mildly narcotic leaf, and so it was known that they would be kind of knocked out and asleep. And as to the urgency of the mission, we know the president, President Obama, approved it on Monday, and this is after reports that the American hostage, Jessica Buchanan, had health issues that were deteriorating, so there was some sense of urgency. What more are you hearing about the raid itself? Quite interesting that they parachuted in. There were reports that there were helicopters on the ground. So did they helicopter out?
That's what we're hearing, yes. Initially, some people in the area told us that they thought the whole operation was carried out by helicopters, between two or four helicopters. But then the American officials made it clear that actually the parachuting in was from a plane. And then getting the two aid workers out safely with the American team, that was by helicopter, so a combination of different aircraft used. But interesting that this was, you know, attempted on land. You know that at least 150 are being held now. But up until now, the kind of wisdom that most people have thought is, well, look, it's too dangerous to go and try and rescue these hostages. We know they'll be released once a ransom is paid. It's not worth the risk. America has taken a bold decision and has put a marker down, really, and it certainly will send a message to the pirates. And I think the message being the international community is getting pretty fed up. But, you know, huge question marks still over what happens to the more than 150 that are still being held in captivity.
Well, people on the ground seem to be very happy. Someone is quoted as saying, "We thank the United States. Pirates have spoiled the whole region's peace and ethics. They are mafia." That's Will Ross, East Africa correspondent for the BBC, speaking to us from Addis Ababa about last night's raid in Somalia on a kind of a rough cell phone line. Will, thanks so much.
Okay.
Huge crowds are once again converging on Tahrir Square in Cairo, Egypt, to celebrate the one-year anniversary of that country's uprising, the one that ousted longtime President Hosni Mubarak. Everyone from liberal activists who are in the square chanting down, down with military rule, to once-banned Islamists, including members of the Brotherhood, who are checking IDs and policing the square, to supporters of the country's current military rulers, are there. The BBC's John Lyne says everyone wants to claim ownership of the revolution.
Now you've got, obviously, the revolutionary youth, the people who really were at the vanguard last year, who want an immediate end to military rule. You've got the Muslim Brotherhood, you've got the majority, or you've got the largest single force in Parliament, and you've got the military rulers, who themselves also are trying to say they're the ones who protected the revolution, and they're organising their own celebrations as well.
On Monday, members of Egypt's new parliament took their seats for the first time. Only a handful of women were elected, and our next guest wasn't one of them. 29-year-old Dalia Ziada ran for office but didn't win. She's an Egyptian human rights activist. She's in Washington this week for meetings at the advocacy group the American Islamic Congress. She serves as director of their bureau in Egypt. And by the way, she translated an American comic book about Martin Luther King to help inspire the revolution. We're going to talk to her more about that. But Dalia, I'm sure you're disappointed you didn't win, yet these were the freest elections in modern Egyptian history. Is there some consolation in that?
Oh, yes, of course. Actually, you know, something that I've been fighting for through my work and even before as an individual activist, it was mainly how to secure civil rights and women's rights in the Egyptian community. Now, through the elections, I'm seeing civil rights is being secured, which is something so great. At least part of what we've been fighting for is now being achieved. Now I believe it's the time to focus more on women's rights.
And why do you think so few women were elected? They helped support about a third of the households in Egypt. We saw what seemed like sort of a burgeoning feminist movement when women were galvanized to hold that historic protest last month after we saw that videotape of the woman. She's now called the Blue Bra Girl. You know who I mean. Her shirt was torn off, and, you know, there was this huge protest. So why were so few women elected?
Unfortunately, this was something expected, and we were, like, trying to deny in Egypt that, well, women can make it till the very end. We had very high expectations after the revolution, after being there in the square side by side with men and, you know, like, sharing the same dream and dreaming about the same future. But what happened immediately after the revolution in March, when women tried to emphasize their rights by a rally in Tahrir Square, they called it 1 million women rally, it was, I believe, the first shock that women received after the revolution.
When you say it was the first shock, what was the shock?
Actually, when 1 million women decide to make this rally, they were not 1 million. The number was much, much less than that. And when they started the rally in Tahrir Square, the same men who were, like, standing by their side a couple of months ago, they went out to the square just to tell them, you have to go back to your homes. It's not your time now, and you should not be here.
Yeah, that sort of reflects the progress in other countries, though, as well. We remember during the civil rights movement here in the 60s, women were disappointed that they didn't have larger roles. And then out of that came later the women's movement. But we remember, too,
that's what I believe is the bright side of all the gloominess we are seeing now in the women's rights scene in Egypt. Now, for example, organizations like ours, the American Islamic Congress, and other organizations working in Egypt on women's rights for years are getting together and forming coalitions to secure a minimum of women's rights in the upcoming constitution and find ways to support women in leadership positions.
Yeah. One of the issues we know you want to take up is female genital mutilation. It's pretty much universal in Egypt. When you were 8, you've told us your mother told you to wear a white party dress for a surprise celebration, and then there was this painful circumcision.
Yes.
First of all, why does it happen? It's not in Islamic law. It's not a religious rite that we know.
That's right. FGM is very common in Egypt. It has been practiced for so many years by Muslim families and Christian families and everyone. It's actually a social custom. And as you know very well, it has horrible psychological consequences on girls because usually the parents don't tell the child that she's going to make an operation or a surgery. So this is the worst thing about it. The people you know most are betraying you. It was not nice. So actually, I've been trying to stop this since I was 8 years old, and I've been exposed to it myself. Now, after, let's say, 15 years from starting this, I remember when, at the very, very beginning, we used to speak about this with my colleagues in university, to people in the street. It was really something unacceptable by the society. But now people are accepting it, and now it's even a national campaign. So I believe it's only a matter of time, a matter of working hard on changing the mindset. And this is what we need now in Egypt, to change the patriarchal mindset towards women.
Do you take encouragement from last month's decision by courts banning those virginity tests? Remember, there was such an uproar after military rulers gave virginity tests to women that they arrested. And so the courts then banned those tests. Does that, you know, give you some encouragement?
Oh, of course, definitely. Actually, I never expected the court will make such a verdict because, you know, the military council is now ruling. And if they did so, probably the judge who makes this decision may be exposing himself to danger or so.
Well, and just briefly touch on the future. We know in the coming months this new parliament is going to write the constitution. Now, the New York Times is reporting that the existing constitution will largely stay in place. There will be clauses that call for Islamic law as the source of Egyptian law, but also clauses that enforce religious freedoms, artistic expression. These have long existed. Some are interpreting this to mean that these ultra-conservative Islamists that have won seats in parliament will not get their way if those clauses stay. Do you feel secure?
No, actually, this is one of my biggest concern, is that our constitution may not be properly drafted or written, because it will determine our future for about at least 50 years from now. Another thing we were just speaking about, that even the women who are in the parliament now, they have won, actually, they are only 8 women, by the way, and they have gotten seats simply because they were on lists that belong to the Islamist parties. So these same women believe very much that woman place is the house. Women should not be competing with men in public places. So imagine how these women would be speaking about women rights in the constitution.
Yeah.
At the same time, the Islamists, who are now form about 80% of the people's assembly, the parliament, are Islamists. And 20% of them are extremists, which means that they don't believe in civil rights or human rights. They consider them Western values.
Yeah.
So I believe it's our role now as civil society groups and civil society activists to stand up for our future, to stand up for making the right constitution, and don't let them just, you know, play with our future as they want.
That's Egyptian human rights activist Dalia Zaidi. We'll be back with more of her incredible journey to activism. And by the way, it involves Martin Luther King. That's the man who inspired her. We'll hear more in 1 minute here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science. Find over 200 job openings at mathworks.com.
Welcome back. We're speaking about where the Egyptian revolution stands a year after the start of protests in Tahrir Square. Dalia Zaidi joins us. She's a 29-year-old Egyptian human rights activist who ran for parliament but lost. In Egypt, she works for the American Islamic Congress, training activists across the country. She was hired by that group back in 2006 after winning an essay contest called The Dream Deferred, sponsored by the AIC's Boston office. We'll post her essay at hereandnow.org. And one of her first tasks for the advocacy organization was to translate a famous 1950s American comic book about Martin Luther King Jr. into Arabic. Now, she'd only just learned about King and was inspired by his belief in nonviolent protest. And Dalia, we understand you had even come up with an Arabic phrase for nonviolent protest.
Yeah.
You didn't have a phrase in Arabic for that.
True.
Could you just briefly tell us what that influence on you has been?
Actually, the best thing about organizations like the American Islamic Congress is that they have an approach that I think led to what we are seeing now in all the changes that are happening in the region. This approach is mainly about working with youth and women. I was one of the youth that the organization worked with even before they hired me. In 2006, I've won in an AC contest. And through this AC contest, I was invited to a conference in Cairo in August 2006. And this conference, for the first time in my life, I was introduced to the legacy of Martin Luther King. And this amazing comic book that happened to be actually one of the main tools that were used in our revolution.
It's amazing to us that somebody hadn't heard of Martin Luther King.
Yeah, actually, we have not heard about Gandhi, Martin Luther King, or those great people. They were panning such stories all the time. I remember the only person we knew about was Malcolm X, and, you know, like a hero or so, and he was introduced like an Islamic or someone who converted to Islam, and so it was not really related. That's why when I saw the Martin Luther King story, you know, this young man who were able to change the history of the U.S. and the whole world by having a nonviolent movement, you know, and the word nonviolent was also very new to me. I didn't know what it meant at that time, and after so, you know, intensive research and working on translating the comic book, it was one of the big challenges, how to turn this word into Arabic, you know, one of the big challenges of the translation. So we invented a two-syllabus word, which is Al-La'unf. And at that time, I remember when I was speaking to, like, very intellectual people about this word, Al-La'unf, or nonviolence, like academics and professors at universities, they did not know what it means. So it was really funny. Now it's used everywhere. It's very common. And we have seen even inside, in the revolution, in the middle of the revolution, people were shouting like, Silmeya, Silmeya. We don't want violence, you know. So it was great.
Well, will you continue to take some of those things you learned when you studied Martin Luther King Jr., will you continue to use them going forward in Egypt? I mean, you know, military rulers are increasingly cracking down on protesters. Security forces last month raided the offices of several pro-democracy organizations, though not yours. You know, we've seen in other countries, I look at Syria, we've seen in other countries that nonviolence hasn't been able to hold.
Yeah, that's true. Actually, one of main reasons of my visit to the U.S. this time, or to our headquarters here this week, actually, is to put the program for the next year. And one of the essential parts of this program is to how to educate people more and more about nonviolent action and strategies, and copy other workshops from what we have been doing in 2007 and 2008, and learn people how to adapt with the new situation in Egypt. I believe in nonviolent action very much, and I think this is our only way out from the crisis we are in now. Actually, we have, you know, on the political scene now, there is a competition between military and Islamists, while the civilians, the young people who started it all, are completely out of the process, which is really shameful, and it's absolutely wrong, and we have to fix this.
Dalia Ziada, Egypt Office Director for the American Islamic Congress in Cairo. Dalia, we wish you the best of luck, and please stay in touch. I just want to ask you also quickly, are you studying the work of Gene Sharp there?
Have
you?
Oh, of course.
Yeah.
Oh. Definitely, yeah. It was this famous book, Moving from Dictatorship to Democracy, was one of the main tools we were using in training the people on nonviolent action and strategies, and even during the revolution, we were distributing it everywhere.
Dalia, thank you so much, and stay in touch, please.
Thanks, Robin. Thank you so much. Of course, I will.
And that's something we mentioned Gene Sharp. He, of course, the former Harvard professor and Nobel Prize nominee based here in the Boston area, who runs the Albert Einstein Institution, a nonprofit organization dedicated to the study and promotion of nonviolent action. His books are read around the world. We'll post our story about Gene Sharp at hereandnow.org. And we have a program note for you tomorrow on Here and Now. In the intelligence business, they call it a false flag. But why would Israeli spies pose as CIA agents to recruit terrorists from a group called Jundallah to attack Iran?
First, it's more likely for a group like Jundallah to talk to Americans than Israelis. The second reason is, I don't think there's any doubt among policymakers here that Israel feels under threat from Iran and wants American protection, and this would pull the United States into the Israeli agenda.
That story tomorrow. And a leave taking today. You might have seen Arizona Congresswoman Gabrielle Giffords' appearance last night at President Obama's State of the Union. Today, she handed in her resignation letter to a teary-eyed House Speaker John Boehner, writing that she doesn't remember that day last January when she was shot. Six people were killed. And then, surrounded by friends on the House floor, she held hands with House colleague Congressman Jeff Flake as an emotional Debbie Wasserman Schultz from Florida read from Giffords' resignation letter further.
The only way I ever served my district in Congress was by giving 100%. I would add it's 150. This past year, that's what I have given to my recovery. Thank you for your patience. Every day I am working hard. I will recover and will return. And we will work together again for Arizona and for all Americans. Sincerely, Gabrielle Giffords, Member of Congress.
Asked about her daughter's future, Giffords' mother, Gloria, said, I think she's transcended Congress. Latest news is next, Here and Now.
Support for Here and Now comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced, and by Harvard University, whose Harvard Extension School has online and on-campus courses for students around the world, extension.harvard.edu. And by the Institute of Contemporary Art Boston, with Isaac Julian's 10,000 Waves, a 9-screen video installation featuring Maggie Chung, icaboston.org.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Parts of parched Texas have seen some release this month. A few inches of rain have fallen in the eastern part of the state, but Gene Hall of the Texas Farm Bureau told the Jacksonville Daily Progress it's a good start, but the drought is not broken by any means. The state suffered its worst single-year drought on record in 2011, and according to the research organization AgriLife, more than 60% of Texas is still under severe drought. That's having a widespread impact on farming, tourism, and animals. In Dallas, police now have to deal with a number of stray donkeys let loose because no one can afford to feed them. Patrick Bonner is senior sergeant at the Dallas County Sheriff's Department. Sergeant Bonner, how many stray donkeys are we talking about here?
Last year, we started out the month of January of 2011 with two donkeys. By the end of the year, we had approximately 35 donkeys on property.
Yeah, well, that's a lot of donkeys, and we understand that it's happening because the drought has led to an increase in hay prices.
Right, that's correct.
Yeah, so that's what donkeys eat. The price of a hay bale before the drought was $80 or $90. Now it's up to $150 or $180. Are people just letting the animals go out of an open gate? Are they trucking them and dropping them off? What's happening?
Well, what it appears to be, like you said, people are just not able to afford these donkeys, not only with just the feed, but there's also medical care for donkeys. We don't know if they're just opening up the gates and letting the donkeys run off, or if they're actually loading them up in their trailers and taking them far off from home and then just let them loose.
Oh, it's awfully sad. And we understand that you have a livestock center where you keep loose livestock there, you know, near your office. The county sheriff is responsible for loose livestock.
That's correct.
You know, whereas people might come retrieve their horse or their cow, they're not coming for the donkeys?
They're not coming for the donkeys at all.
Yeah. So what does this do for the police force? What do you have to do because of this?
Well, with the police force, it's causing strain on budgets because, again, we have to feed these donkeys. It's costing approximately $8 a day per donkey to feed. It also takes away some of the deputies on the street who's going out and either investigating calls or investigating accidents. Mm. We do have one livestock deputy, but when he's not on duty, somebody else has to pick up his duties. So we do have to either pull deputies off the street to either go pick up livestock or pull me out of the office and drive the truck and go pick those up.
And it's, I'm imagining, not easy to wrangle a donkey.
Oh, no, it's not easy at all.
Yeah. Well, so here's the tender question. Can you continue to afford to do this? I mean, I hate the alternative, which might be, you know, bringing them to auction or euthanizing them.
Right. Well, here, our sheriff is, she's an animal lover. So as far as euthanizing animals, we don't do that. That's one of the main reasons why we held on to donkeys so long last year, just hoping that either someone will come claim them or find a rescue organization that will pick them up.
Well, and we know one surfaced, a group called Peaceful Valley Donkey Rescue?
Yes. Recently, they just picked up 20, which helped us out tremendously, and we have approximately 10 left on property now.
Will you be forced to auction off some, or?
Well, we've tried to auction them off in the past. The lowest amount that I've seen so far has been a dollar, and we still hadn't been able to get rid of them. So we continue to keep those here until places like Peaceful Valley can come pick those up.
Well, anyone who's ever had a donkey help you get down the Grand Canyon, or, I mean, donkeys,
right.
You know, they have quite a bit of value, but apparently people not yet seeing it there where you are. We understand you also have people from the Department of Corrections, inmates from the Department of Corrections come out and help you feed them. Where do you think this is going to go?
We're hoping that people will just take the time and really think, you know, can I afford these animals? You know, they are good work animals, but they have to be fed. And when they're turning them loose like that, they're turning that back onto the taxpayer. So I don't know the answer to that. We're just hoping that people will take the time and really figure out, can I afford this animal before I purchase them and bring them home?
Patrick Bonner, Senior Sergeant at the Dallas County Sheriff's Department. Thanks so much.
Thank you so much.
And up next in Miami, viewers missed out on the Golden Globe Awards. In Corpus Christi, Texas, NBC and Telemundo were blocked out. In Boston, subscribers to DirecTV can't watch Channel 7. What? The Super Bowl's on that channel. We'll have more on the cable wars and your letters in 30 seconds here and now.
And the Patriots take the knee and will now take the journey to Indianapolis. To Super Bowl 46.
Oh, yes, they are, to battle the New York Giants. But sports fans here in Boston may not be able to follow them on TV if they subscribe to DirecTV, which I do. Sunbeam Television, which owns the local NBC affiliate here, has failed to come to an agreement with DirecTV over retransmission rights. These are the fees that cable and satellite providers pay to companies like Sunbeam to air their local affiliates. So that means that if you tune to Channel 7 here in Boston, you get a sign saying, in effect, this is Channel 7's fault. In Miami, viewers missed out on the Golden Globes. In Corpus Christi, Texas, a dispute with Time Warner blacked out NBC, Telemundo, and the CW. Last year, more than 30 markets had blackouts. Alex Sherman of Bloomberg News joins us. Alex, members of Congress, we know, are urging these groups to come into agreement. My carrier, as I said, if you tune to the channel, there's a sign there. They imply that it's the channel's fault. If you go to Channel 7's website, they say it's DirecTV's fault. You know, just broadly, what's at the root of this fight cross-country?
Well, like almost any problem in these aspects, the problem is money. This is a negotiation between a large pay TV provider and a company that owns a group of local networks. And the issue here is that the local networks want more money from DirecTV in this case, but it's happened to lots of large cable providers, Comcast, Time Warner Cable. They've all gone through this. And the issue here is based on a 1992 Cable Act that was passed that allows these local news channels to collect money from the large pay TV providers in order to sort of keep their operation going. But what's happened is these companies like Sunbeam have wanted more and more money as the years have gone by, and it started to really cut in to the bottom line of the larger pay TV providers, and they're sort of taking a stand and saying, no more, this is getting too expensive, so we're not going to carry your channel if you keep asking for so much money, and that's what's happening here.
And they seem to be using these big events as some sort of leverage, although that we should say last week here in the Boston area, DirecTV relented and they let viewers watch the Giants game here on local television. But the FCC is expected to review the rules on the subject. A professor at Fordham University who's looked at all of this says, you know, local stations are getting much bigger fees. What do you think is going to happen?
It's a good question. You know, the FCC does want to take a look at this because if the fees just keep going up and up and up, there's going to be a problem, in essence. And the issue sort of revolves around just how important are local news stations. For example, these same types of disputes happen with your larger cable networks, too. For instance, in the New York area, we're seeing a dispute right now between Time Warner Cable and MSG, which carries the New York Knicks games, among other sporting events. the government maybe is less likely to get involved in something like that, which is just between two private companies, than in this issue, even though the companies are also private, there's sort of an inherent importance to broadcast news because there are various things like weather updates and school closings that a lot of people get from their local news carrier. And because of that, I think the government may be more likely to step in and say, you know what, we can't have Channel 7 in Boston go off the air for weeks at a time because there's, you know, we'll lose those things to the consumers that subscribe to DirecTV. So we'll see what happens. You know, at this point, John Kerry has written a letter, and the question now is how does the FCC get involved? Do they say, you know what, you guys just can't keep forcing these increases, we need to put a percentage cap on it, or maybe they come up with another solution?
Alex Sherman of Bloomberg News on this battle over retransmission fees that's blacking out some stations, hopefully resolved by Super Bowl Sunday. Alex, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Well, Doug Miller of Anchorage, Alaska, recently wrote to say, you should read more letters. So, okay, we will. We heard from a lot of you after our interview with Shalom Auslander, whose new darkly comic novel, Hope, a Tragedy, imagines Anne Frank as an elderly Holocaust survivor living in an attic in New York. He said he wanted to explore the question, can Jews remember the Holocaust without living a life of victimhood because of it? Well, many of you found it hilarious. Some of you did not. Jonathan Rosenbaum, Professor Emeritus of Jewish Studies at Gratz College and a visiting scholar at the University of Pennsylvania, writes, there were many Jews who survived the Holocaust in attics, aided by non-Jews who took grave risks to protect them. Many, including Anne Frank, were murdered. Mr. Auslander's sarcasm and your encouraging laughter are affronts both to the victims and to their protectors. We also recently had a report on celebrity chef Paula Deen, who's taking some flack for pushing fatty foods while knowing she herself had come down with diabetes. Well, M. Chamberlain, living in the Blue Ridge Mountains of Virginia, called to say, lighten up.
I think it's time that some Southerners stood up and advocated for our food. You don't eat it every day. You shouldn't eat it every day. But on Sunday dinner, it's like being with your dead relatives. When you can sit down and you can eat the food that we've eaten for generations, there's no way I could eat like that every day and still be alive. But I love my deep fried chicken. I love fried biscuits. I would fry anything that doesn't move, and I'll pour gravy on anything that isn't nailed down once a week.
Well, then there were the powerful stories we heard from people with not enough to eat. Our primer on food stamps was prompted by Newt Gingrich's remarks on the campaign trail. Many of you sent your experiences. This woman from Oklahoma City didn't want her name used.
When my husband decided to open his own business, we got pregnant. You know, we were really struggling, and food stamps was something that we never thought we'd apply for, but getting on that was one of the best decisions we did to help our family and make sure we could feed our kids. And as we have become more successful, our food stamp level has dropped. And under the Obama administration, he actually lessened the amount of food stamps that each family got, which I think is more of an incentive for most people to get off of food stamps.
And finally, last week, we brought you the story of the Robin Becker dance troupe's interpretation of a story that was told in David Marinus's book, They Marched Into Sunlight. It's the story of one day in 1968 when police attacked peaceful protesters at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, while in Vietnam, 60 U.S. troops were killed in an ambush. One listener wrote us, your piece brought back so many memories. I was at the university walking past the Commerce Building when I saw students running in panic. I'd been aware of the student protests but didn't get involved. After that incident, I did. Then I was drafted, sent to Vietnam. I was assigned to the 1st Infantry Division, the Big Red One. We provided artillery support to the famed Black Lions, the very same battalion that was involved in that ambush. By the time I was in country, there were no infantry personnel left from the fated ambush. However, the tales were told. Thanks for telling them again. John Lecklam, University of Wisconsin, Class of 1968, U.S. Army, 1968-70. And, of course, we'd always love to hear from you. Go to hearnow.org. You can leave a comment there. You can click through to Facebook, hit contact, send us an email. Back in a minute, Here and Now. Welcome back. You may not know the name Kevin Gordon, but you may know his music. Keith Richards and the band covered his Deuce and a Quarter.
I buy a bottle, get the feeling good. A world's looking like you think it should.
You can also hear his sounds on HBO's True Blood. And then there's the duet that Kevin Gordon did with Lucinda Williams on his Down to the Well.
Ain't going down to the well no more. Believe I've had my fill. Went the ground till I done got sore. Ain't going back down to the well.
American Songwriter magazine calls Kevin Gordon the most accomplished but underrated songwriter and guitarist in Nashville. He's on tour with a new CD, Gloryland, his first in 7 years, and Kevin Gordon joins us in the studio. Welcome.
Thank you.
And tell us, underrated, most accomplished, are you the, we think, maybe only singer-songwriter with a master's degree in poetry from the prestigious Iowa Writers Workshop?
Well, yes.
Or are there many others we don't know about?
It's a degree that will get you a nice job washing dishes just about anywhere, waiting tables. It is kind of a rare thing in Nashville to find people who went to grad school in creative writing like that.
Well, let's see how your poetry and your music come together in this song, which is inspired by the work of quilt maker and folk artist Picolia Warner. It's called Picolia Star.
Thimbles and thread, bag of rags and scraps of laughter. Mama's quilt like a flag. A friendship's unfurled.
Tell us more about Picolia Warner.
Okay, she was an African-American quilter who lived in Yazoo City, Mississippi. And I read a chapter of a book, and each chapter was like a first-person monologue of the artist talking to you.
Tell me, have you seen Picolia Star?
And within 10 minutes, I was writing that song.
Yeah.
It was her voice that got to me.
You'd be safe and warm under Picolia Star.
Well, and we hear, you know, scraps of her and, you know, the scraps of fabric and things in the song. And you've been called a chronicler of life in the South, and on this new CD, songs speak to that. The one that's getting the most attention is Colfax Step in Time, a story about the day your 7th grade marching band met the Ku Klux Klan. Discuss. What happened?
We were marching in a parade in a little town named Colfax, and along the parade route there, we turned a corner, and here's the Klan handing out pamphlets.
In their white dunce caps and robes with red crosses embroidered on, like gilded leaves on an automatic rifle, or an image of the suffering Christ airbrushed on the side of a missile in broad daylight. Donald Lovelady said he thought they only came.
I don't think the gravity of it hit me, being 13 at the time, but as the years went on, I started thinking more and more about how our band director, who was African American, Mr. Minifield, he is now Dr. Minifield, how he felt about it and what his response to that encounter was. A stoic courage. He kept looking straight ahead. I like that because it doesn't give you the easy answer of he wasn't scared, just that he kept going. That gesture of him continuing to walk by these guys said a lot to me.
Didn't say a word. Minifield didn't turn his head, just kept marching, looking straight ahead, looking straight ahead, like there was somewhere better he was going. But this was the only goddamn way to get there today. With his baton in the air, looking straight ahead.
Kevin Gordon, another theme that runs through the CD, besides the obvious Southern one, is the road. You know, and I have to say, you know, your road trips are not like mine. let's listen to just a little montage here. First, there's trying to get to Memphis, Heartbreaker, a guy begging for gas money so he can take his wife to her father's funeral.
This guy came to the door last night. Don't you remember me? I cleaned your gutters last fall. Well, the dealer's seat, that's my wife in the car there. And her daddy just died. Yeah, my tank's on empty and I ain't got a dime. Just trying to get to Memphis.
That happened to you?
It did. That was a song about a fellow who comes to my door. He tells me this heartbreaking story. So it's just being kind of caught in that dilemma of wanting to do the right thing,
right,
wanting to believe the guy.
Then there's Side of the Road. Could you just briefly tell us the story behind this?
Sure. That song grew out of a series of kind of montages that I'd written in my journal over the years. The second verse is about coming upon a scene of a church having been burned down probably the night before because the remains were still smoldering. Mm. And this was on a two-lane highway somewhere outside of Donaldsonville, Louisiana. I was on the road. I was driving from Houston to Jackson, Mississippi. And in the middle of nowhere, here's this scene with this preacher standing out by the highway with this plywood sign in his hands. What stuck with me was the way that he spelled out the words, God's way. But on the sign, he had painted it G-O-D on the top line, S-W-A-Y on the second line.
Who comes upon preachers standing next to smoldering churches holding signs that say, God's sway?
Mm-hmm.
You know, wow.
Yeah. I immediately pulled out my notebook at the time and wrote that down. I mean, not that I would ever forget it.
Church in the country, burned to the ground. Congregation all gathered around. Preacher in his robe, shining red in the sun. Held a sign that said it's God's way. Everyone by the road, by the side of the road. They were praying by the side of the road.
Nashville singer-songwriter Kevin Gordon, his new CD is Glory Land. We'll leave you with that title song. For more on the music, go to herenow.org. Kevin, thanks so much for the taste of the South.
You're
in
welcome.
Our studio here in Boston. Thank you.
You're welcome.
You might be the president, take a lot of power in your hands. Bend the laws to your advantage, drive your armies to a foreign land. You say your call is just lonely. You must just to keep them believing they're on their way to glory land. You must keep believing. Keep deceiving, and I'm my brother's keeper.
she walked as a smiling child, a blown to rubber, death and infidels all around. You're drinking thirst, eating hunger, praying to the east, and the mullah is the only one you can trust. Who gives himself to the sacrifice, passes the gate to paradise. The mark, cool wind across your face, virgin visions in your head, and a bomb strapped to your waist. It's always